You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now we are joined by... Hey, she's Ellen Blackman for Dear Science. Ellen, how are you going?
Hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Very well.
Okay, awesome. I'm just going to pass this on to Ruben and Will, and they can take it away.
So, Ellen, basically your first piece, Saturn probe turns towards death plunge. Tell us about that.
That's a good headline. I like that. Yes, yes. Well, proceed. So this coming Friday, the 15th, there's a spacecraft that's going around Saturn at the moment, and it is going to plunge into the atmosphere and be destroyed. And so this is the end of a 20-year odyssey for this spacecraft, which is called the Cassini probe, and that was launched in 1997, and it took all of 7 years to get to orbit around Saturn, which is a long time. Saturn's about 1.2 billion kilometres away from us, give or take. And so if you were going to take a direct line there, if you hopped in the car and sort of went at 100 kilometres an hour, it'd take you around about 1,300 years to get there. So it is an awfully, awfully long way away. And so the whole point of this was to explore Saturn and its moons, and to also land a probe on the largest of Saturn's moons, which is Titan, the second largest moon in the solar system. And it did that. That was called the Huygens probe, and that landed safely on the surface of Titan, and it transmitted photos and stuff back for about 90 minutes.
Yeah, so what did they find on Titan?
Rocks. Well, given that Saturn hasn't got a hell of a lot of rocks, the its moon certainly does, but they found rocks. They also found seas of liquid methane as a combination, I guess, between the Cassini and the Huygens probe, which is kind of unusual. A surface temperature of negative lots, not a lot of sunlight, an orange atmosphere, and a pretty remarkable effort being able to land a probe on a moon of another planet, you know, and especially being so far away. The shame is it only sort of got to transmit for 90 minutes, and now it's going to sit there for eternity. I guess it's, you know, quite extraordinary. But Cassini itself, it found an awful lot of things. So in addition to the liquid on Titans, it sort of found storms and hurricanes on Saturn. Found sort of radio waves emanating from the planet. And nobody knows sort of what their origin is, so that's kind of unusual. It found six new moons of Saturn itself. It's been flying in and out of Saturn's rings, so it managed to do that without any damage, which is quite extraordinary because they're made up of little sort of rocks, basically. And so now the feeling is that they don't want any trace of it left, I guess. They don't want it just sort of floating around in outer space, and so they're going to destroy it. And so that's what's going to happen on Friday morning, unfortunately.
So like a environmentally friendly space policy?
Yes, apart from the fact that it's got 33 kilos of plutonium on board. and that's the way that it powers itself, I guess. So, that's running out now. And so that's, again, the reason why this is coming to an end, because to quote NASA, I think they're running on fumes at the moment.
Right. So will it go boom?
Well, probably not a lot of oxygen there to make it go boom, I guess. So it's probably just going to sort of just die a death, I guess. Probably get crushed by the enormous atmospheric pressure up there or whatever. So, it's going to be... Going to be kind of sad, but it's an absolutely remarkable story. And they sent back a lot of data. Sort of reading up about this, they sent back about 600 or 700 gigabytes of data. And you might think, well, sure, that's not much. You know, you can whip down to the shop and grab yourself a terabyte disk for under $100, sort of thing. But remember, it was built in 1997, so we're talking 1997, 20-year-old computer technology. And so that was, you know, obviously a big deal in those days. And, you know, the sad thing is that we can't sort of instantly replace it with up-to-date technology at the moment, so...
So do you reckon there'll be a funeral held for it?
I would imagine that NASA or JPL or wherever they're running this from, I would think that they would be, yeah, having a few whiskeys, to quote our last report, the last text there, yeah.
More whiskey and better suits.
More whiskey and better suits, I love that.
All right, so on to our next piece. Why Big Pharma gets a bad name?
Well, they don't really go out of their way to help themselves, do they? Honestly. I do try and sort of stand up for them, but they do make it difficult sometimes. Okay, so we've got a company called Allergan over in the States, and their claim to fame amongst various eyewear, which is what they're most known for, is Botox. So they have the patent for that. And they've also got a patent for a thing called Restasis, which is used for dry eyes. And this earns them about $1.5 billion a year. Billion, not million, billion a year. And this is under patent for them until 2024. Now, the way that this whole bloody drug company thing seems to operate is that you get these people who make generic drugs, so which are the same drug, but they're made by different people off patent. And once a drug goes off patent, then you can make generic copies of it and you can sell it.
So like home brand sort of
Essentially,
drugs.
Yeah. Of course, you know, to the same quality standards and everything like that. But they don't have to put in the R&D that the initial discoverers have to, okay? Which is an enormous outlay, and that's why they get the patent protection, so they can make that enormous outlay back. And by an enormous outlay, there's a paper in the online today which sort of is saying that the average cost of a drug is sort of in the $2 billion, $3 billion amount, and that's for successful drugs. It doesn't count the cost of the unsuccessful ones.
So that's just for research and testing
Forth. Yeah, so that's all the R&D that goes into it. So, you know, it's a buttload of money, and they've got to make that back somehow. So we've got a couple of generic companies over in the States who have taken Allergan to court, who are trying to invalidate the patent on this Restatin stuff, and which would then mean that they could make it and sell it and make lots and lots of money. And the Supreme Court last year said, yep, okay, there might be something to this, so we might have an investigation into this. So Allergan have gone ahead and basically transferred the patent rights to the St. Regis Mohawk Indian Nation, who come from upstate New York, an Indian tribe in upstate New York. And so they've transferred the patent rights to them, and then the Indian Nation are then leasing the rights back to Allergan for something like, I think it was $50 million a year, something like that. So the tribe are doing very, very well out of it. Allergan are going to retain their patent rights because, this is the kicker, that the IP owned by the tribe is immune to Supreme Court review.
Wow. How?
It's some weird legal thing in the States, but that's the way it is. So if they own the IP, they can't be investigated by the Supreme Court. And so they just did this last week, and this has sent absolute shockwaves through the whole big pharma thing and through the whole patent law circles and everything. Because obviously now all the drug companies are going to be cozying up to Indian tribes very probably, and it's not only casinos that are going to make the money, very possibly, unless the law gets changed, they're going to, you know, be licensed or licensing all of these drugs, very, very possibly.
And not just drug companies, though. You'd have all sorts of corporations with patents that might be being attacked in the Supreme Court.
Yep. So can of worms, very possibly. Now, I hasten to add that this is not the fault of the scientists. These are the lawyers. Come on, okay? Yeah. So the scientists just make the drugs. It's the lawyers and everybody that gives Big Pharma a bad name, sadly. And I'm not sure I can defend them on this one. But having said that, these two companies who are, you know, sort of having a go at them, these two generic companies, they're not blameless either, because this seemingly goes on quite a bit, is that the generics companies try and exploit any holes in patents and stuff like that. So, you know, the only people who come out winning are the lawyers, as usual, anyway. So,
although the scientists do choose who to work for, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean,
or Ruben, you know, does the money choose?
Well, yeah. Well, the scientists that work for tobacco companies.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, there we go.
Go on. They chose to work for them.
I'm not scientists,
they?
You know. I'm not going to offend them. No, well, no, no, no.
We'll move on to our next item, shall we?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So, an alternative apricot cancer treatment. Tell us about that.
Yes, indeed. Excuse me. Those of you with long, long memories might remember in the 70s there was a drug called Laetril, and there was a guy by the name of Dr. Milan Brick. But you guys are all
I know.
You weren't born then, I know. So it's totally lost on you. You might have a listener of a particular vintage, possibly. But He was touting this stuff called Laetril, which was supposedly a cure for cancer. He got kicked off the medical board in New Zealand. He ended up in the Cook Islands, and and long story short, it's obviously not a cure for cancer. It is, however, derived from apricot kernels. And there's a thing in apricot kernels called amygdalin. And this is a compound that when it decomposes, it releases cyanide. Now, somebody's got it into their head that this stuff could well be a cure for cancer. And it's touted all over the internet, as these things often are. And so in the British Medical Journal last week, there's a story of a 67-year-old Australian man who went in for some routine surgery. And it was noted that all was not as it should have been. He went into hypoxia under just sort of general anesthesia. His oxygen was very, very low. And they eventually traced this back to the fact that he was eating lots of apricot kernels because he was a survivor of prostate cancer. And to stop it coming back, he had read on the internet it's a good idea to eat these apricot kernels. What he didn't know was that the apricot kernels, this amygdalin compound, releases cyanide in the body. And what he was doing was eating the equivalent of about 17 milligrams of cyanide per day. Now, the lethal dose of cyanide ranges, depending on your body weight, anywhere from 100 mg to 500 mg. So he was eating a significant proportion of a lethal dose of cyanide every day. And this was not doing great things to his body, because obviously cyanide will kill you, and it kills you by binding to the iron inside you. So there's a thing called cytochrome oxidase, which is an enzyme. The cyanide binds to the iron and that, and it doesn't come back off as it should, and that's what ends up killing you. And so, yeah, I guess the moral of the story is just be very, very careful what you read on the internet. Now, sadly, apparently the guy has resumed his apricot kernel regime, sadly, despite the best medical advice, and he's continuing on taking it. So,
yeah. So I read that he took 20 times the safe limit of cyanide a day.
And so did I. And I went and looked that up, and I think they've got that wrong. Right. So it's about 1.5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight is the lethal dose. So yeah, it's not 20 times the lethal dose, but it's a significant fraction.
Well, but maybe the safe limit is something different, though, because there is often cyanide in rice, for example.
Yeah,
right?
Indeed. Yep, yep.
And
yep,
people consume a lot of rice, so maybe there's like a health guideline to how much could safely be consumed.
Yeah, and again, there'll be a cumulative amount as well. So it depends how quickly it something happens to it in the body, because it does get detoxified in the body, but mostly not before it kills you. So obviously, tiny doses are okay, but you know, you don't want to be taking 17 milligrams of cyanide. No, I certainly wouldn't do that in the lab. That's not a career advancing move, you know. So
this is definitely a throwback to us talking for countless weeks about how seriously it's been going on far too long. You think people would listen and go, "Hey," about alternative medicines and the word cure. There's no such thing as a 100% cure for something. You can't. Well,
no, I think, I think we've talked about this before. Yeah, and no, you're absolutely right.
I mean, it's a dangerous thing to see the words alternative medicine and cure and just go, yep, that's probably it.
Mm. And of course, there's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine and there's not.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, all the alternative medicines, I've said this before, all the alternative medicines that actually work become medicine because they work.
There we go. Yes. And one of the really nasty things they've done with this Laetril stuff, which is the derivative of the stuff in apricot kernels, they've gone and called it vitamin B17 on the internet. And now, oh, that's just bad. That's really, really, really bad. The evil people who do that, they're evil.
Vitamins are good, Alan.
Vitamins are good. Vitamins, quote, are essential nutrients required in limited amounts.
Yeah.
Okay? This stuff is not an essential nutrient required in limited amount. It's not a bloody vitamin, and the people who call it that are just evil. Simple as that.
So why do you think this guy just continues to take it, even though he knows?
Well, you know, stuff that you read on the internet obviously has a real power. You know, it's you know, gospel truth, isn't it? Mm.
Our next segment.
On the internet, it must be real.
Our next segment, has clickbait gone too far?
Yeah, well, that basically concludes Dear Science today.
I'm just going to take over from here. Thanks, Ruben. And thank you very much, Alan, for coming in, having a chat to us. Feel free to stick around till the end. We've got, I believe, Wednesday Wire does what is it? Fun facts or something stupid like that?
Oh,
I don't know.
Thank you.
Well, okay, because I used to be on Thursday Wire and I initiated this thing, which was like advice, and it was my fun thing that I did. And then Wednesday Wire obviously wanted to step up their game.
Ah.
And so they took on board, kind of tweaked it a bit. It's not quite as good, but it works.
Well, I think we should go back to the whiskey tasting we had two weeks ago. I think that was excellent.
Sounds like a right time. Yeah, yeah, we'll get in contact with you about that. Yes, Ruben.
Is anything really original, though?
Get out of my face. Okay, now we are going to have quite an apt tune for what we've been discussing. Very sciencey. This is Aliens by the Echo O's. BFM.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.